Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on The Bible Answers Your Questions right after this message. You know, Charles Lyell is one of the pillars of modern geology, and it was Lyell who published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated them. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins or beginnings was devised, and it simply projected all natural processes back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out, and this process is blatantly called science. Well, listen to this. When we talk about erosion, what's even more surprising is the discovery that all of the continents on planet Earth would be worn down to sea level in just 14 million years. So if we just take a look at the Colorado River and the Amazon and the Nile and the amount of sediments and the rate of erosion that's going on right now today, in 14 million years, the Andes will and the Himalayas will be worn down to sea level. But you know, there isn't any evidence for such drastic erosion. The mountains and the valleys on Earth appear to have been very recently made. They are sharp and angular in appearance, and it testifies to their youthfulness. You know, all you have to do is go back 14 million years if erosion has been going on at this rate. 14 million years. Then add 14 million years, then add another 14 million years, and the Earth isn't worn down smooth yet. And now, what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of dinosaurs? Talking about time, that was 65 million years ago. You know, 15, 30, 45, 60, that's four cycles ago. Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudoscientific lies. And this is just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the guise of science. And that's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? It's free. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Do it right now before you forget. All right, I got a question in here from a young fella named Steve. He says, I had a quick question about usury. While forbidden in the Old Testament, how do you explain Christ's seeming endorsement of usury in Matthew 25, verse 27, and Luke 19, verse 23? It doesn't make any sense to me. Thanks, Steve. Well, all right, Steve, let's take a look at Matthew 25, verse 27, and look at usury and see what did the Messiah have to say about it. He said, "You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received my own with usury." All right. First of all, that's a statement that's taken out of the middle of a context of a story. So let's listen to the story first. It's repeated in Luke 16, so we'll just take Matthew 25. It's the parable of the talents. Parable of the talent. And it begins in Matthew 25:14, and it runs through 25:30. So it's about 15 verses here. that tells a little story about the parable of the talent. So let's listen to the parable of the talent. He said, "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto the one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went out and traded with the same, and he made them another 5 talents. And then likewise he that had received 2, he also gained another 2. But he that had received the 1 talent went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoned with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought another 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. I've doubled your money. And his Lord said to him, Well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of your Lord. And he also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered unto me 2 talents. Behold, I've gained another 2 talents beside them. And his Lord said to him, Well done, you good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter you into the joy of the Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and he said, Well, I knew you that you were a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not strawed. And I was afraid. So I went and I hid your talent in the earth. And lo, here thou hast that is thine. And his Lord answered and said to him, You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reaped where I sowed not and gathered where I have not strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which has 10 talents. For unto every one that has shall be given, and he shall have abundance, and from him that has not shall be taken away even that which he has." Now that's not very politically correct, is it? And he said, Then cast you the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All right, so there's the story. Now, that's a business story. I use that story quite often in my business school. Notice that the master here expects you to double your money. And, of course, it's that doubling process that makes wealth. Wealth isn't made from labor, it's made from wealth. Wealth comes from wealth. It takes money to make money. You've heard that old adage or that old story. And so here's God comes along and he says, I'm going to give you 5 talents. If I gave you 5 talents, could you turn it into 10 and could you do that in 1 year? Because if you can, if you could double your money using geometric progression, you'd double your money in 1 year. It would only take you a few years to make $1 million. Just try it. Take a penny and double it 32 times. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. It amounts to $40 million on the 32nd doubling. So if you could do that every year in 32 years, you'd have $40 million. So if you started with a penny today and just bought, sold, and traded with it for 1 whole year, could you double that penny to 2 pennies? Could you double the 2 pennies to 4 pennies the following year and 4 pennies to 8 pennies by buying, selling, and trading? Most people would tell me, well, certainly I could do that, until you ask them the question, well, if I gave you $1 million, could you take it out and buy, sell, and trade with it, and in 1 year come back with $2 million? Well, why is it that you could take a penny or a dollar out and accomplish that, but you couldn't take $1 million? Now, that's the principle that's being expounded here. It's buying, selling, and trading. That's where the money's at. That's where wealth is generated. So here's the Messiah. He gives 5 talents to 1 guy, goes up, buys, sells, and trades. Doesn't say how long the time period is. Could be a year, 5 years, I don't know. But he doubled his money. Now, if you put your money in the bank at 5% interest, it will double in 15 years. So had this slothful servant taken the 1 talent and just delivered it to Bank of America, put it into a time CD or invested it in U.S. Treasury bills, or did something with, over a period of time. And that one talent would have doubled to two talents in 14.7 years at 5% interest. All right. Now, that being the case, here's the Messiah comes to this guy and he says, now, why didn't you at least put my money in the bank? Now, Steve here asks the question, well, it seems to run counter to the prohibition against usury in the Old Testament. That's what Steve asked. He said, I had a quick question about usury. He goes on to say in the second sentence, while forbidden in the Old Testament, comma. Well, Steve, who told you that usury was forbidden in the Old Testament? Or put another way, do you know that for a fact? All right, so now let's take a look at the word usury. If you went to Strong's Concordance, you'd find that the word usury appears in the Scripture 23 times. Now, in the old days, I would take, in a code pleading operation like this, now remember, we're going to code plead this out and find out, well, what's the story on usury? Because if you were to ask a Lutheran, he'd give you one story, and he'd say, well, that comes from our church, or our catechism, or that's our doctrine. And you go to a Catholic, and it'll be something different. And then you go to a Methodist, or a Jew, or somebody else, and they'll come up with different ideas. And the reason for that is, the Scripture is written, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, that you might go, fall backward, be broken, ensnared, and taken. And the objective of speaking in parables is what? Why did Jesus speak in parables? Well, he told you the answer to that riddle in Matthew 13. He says, I'm speaking to you in parables so that you can't understand what I'm telling you. And a good understanding have all they who do his commandments. Now, the Scripture also says the Scripture cannot be broken. So if Jesus is contradicting the law of the Old Testament, then the Scripture can be broken, can't it? And the statement that says that he's the God that cannot lie isn't true, because he can lie, can't he? And the Scripture says, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So now when we put these Scriptures together, either one, the Scripture contradicts itself, or it doesn't. And it's my contention that the Scripture does not contradict. Let's see if that's true. In looking at the word usury, we first see it in Exodus 22, verses 25 through 27. And there are about five statutes on usury. Take us maybe 5 minutes. Let's just run through them. In Exodus 22, 25 through 27, if you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer, and neither shall you lay upon him usury. If you at all take your neighbor's raiment to pledge, that's called collateral, you shall deliver it unto him by that the sun goes down, for that it is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep. And it shall come to pass, when he cries unto me, that I will hear, because I'm gracious. So we can see that if you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as an usurer, and neither shall you lay upon him usury. All right, now the qualification here is poor. Poor. That's number one. If he's poor by you, you can't charge him usury. Well, does that mean that if he's rich, you could? Don't know yet. The reason we don't know is we don't have all of the statutes on usury yet in front of us to make that kind of a conclusion. But just based upon that statement, it would appear you could lend to the rich, but not to the poor. And here's the problem that religious people have. They'll read a statement like that and they'll say, well, there's our doctrine, or here's our conclusion. And it's premature. Nor, as they say in law, it's not ripe for adjudication yet. We're not ready to make a decision because we haven't seen Leviticus 25, verses 35 through 38. So let's look at the next scripture. Leviticus 25, verses 35 through 38 adds a little more. And if your brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with you, then you shall relieve him. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you, take you no usury of him. It says take no usury of him that's a stranger or a sojourner. So first of all, we got a poor guy. We don't know if he's a stranger or sojourner or not. But that's one class of persons that you can't lend upon usury. Now we've got strangers. That's a second class. A sojourner is a third class. That he may live with you. Take thou no usury of him or increase. But fear God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not give him your money upon usury, nor lend him any victuals for increase. So, this usury is prohibited either in money or in victuals. That is, you can't lend him corn, you know, 50 bushels of corn for a return of 55 bushels. That's usury. A percentage of the original is usury. All right, now he goes on to say, I'm the Eternal, your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20 adds a little more to the story. You shall not lend upon usury to your brother, that is usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Unto a stranger you may lend upon usury, but unto thy brother you shall not lend upon usury, and the Lord your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to do in the land where you go in to possess it. My God, now that sounds like that in Leviticus 25:35 you can't lend to a stranger, and now here in Deuteronomy 23 says, yep, you could lend to a stranger. Well, there's an obvious contradiction. Well, I guess now we can throw the Bible out, because there we have it. An obvious, blatant contradiction. I get that kind of crap all the time. You know, somebody will write a letter and they'll say, see, let me show you something here. But we still haven't got all of the story yet. So far we've got 3/5 of the story. And people come to conclusions based upon 1, 2, or 3 scriptures. Let's try one more. Deuteronomy 24:6. No man shall take the neither or the upper millstone to pledge, for he has a man's life to pledge. All right. Again, we have a second prohibition against collateral. Now, you know, when you go to borrow money at the bank, they always require collateral, don't they? Now, when you lend to somebody under this scriptural prohibition here on usury, or under these usury statutes, the prohibition is against usury. We got 3 classes of people here so far, and you can't take collateral. And that's twice we've seen this collateral put in. And then the last one here is in Deuteronomy 24, verses 10 through 13. When you do lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. You shall stand abroad, and the man to whom you do lend shall bring out the pledge abroad unto you. And if the man be poor, you shall not sleep with his pledge. In any case, you shall deliver him the pledge again when the sun goes down, that he may keep, or he may sleep, rather, in his own raiment, and bless you, and he shall, and it shall be righteousness unto you before the Lord your God. In Deuteronomy 23:19 and 20, it says, unto a stranger you may lend upon usury, but unto your brother you shall not lend upon usury, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to do in the land where you go in to possess it. Sounds like a contradiction here. If your brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with you, when you shall relieve him, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you, take no usury of him or increase. But here's the answer to the riddle. You could lend to a stranger, not a Hebrew, but you could lend to a stranger who's outside of your gates. I could lend to the Bank of America, a multinational corporation, and take usury. But I couldn't lend to a fellow Hebrew. I couldn't lend to a poor Hebrew, and the Arabs have a very unique system. They don't lend upon usury, they lend upon a percentage of the business. Let me show you why it's so important, if you're going to lend or enter into business, that you leave the usury or the percentage out and take a piece of the action. Let's suppose you wanted to borrow money from an Arab. He wouldn't charge you usury. He would take a 25%, 10%, or some percent of interest in the business. And that gives him an incentive for you to succeed. Whereas if you borrow money from the bank, they have an incentive for you to fail. One time I borrowed money from a bank to have an airplane worked on. And then when I borrowed the money and had the money, used it on the airplane, came in and said, now I need another loan or I need an extension. The guy says, no, we're going to foreclose on you. He doesn't have a business interest in the airplane. What he has is a usury interest, a collateral interest. And when I fail, he gets the whole airplane with all of the improvements on it. They do the same thing with houses. They put a balloon payment on your house. That way, when you get to the end, you can't make the balloon payment, and you've made all of the payments except the balloon. Now they take your house. Right, now that's a form of theft. So we could lend to a stranger that's not within our gates, but we can't lend to a stranger that's within our gates. That's the difference. Now when we go to the New Testament, the Messiah says to the guy, well, why didn't you at least put it out to usury? You didn't have to lend it to some guy and charge him usury in violation of the usury statute, but you surely could have put it to the exchangers. All right, now remember the first scripture we talked about here, if you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, what if the guy ain't poor? What if the guy's got plenty of money? What if he's not poor, but he has interests outside the country? The buying, the selling, the trading, the using of usury and interest in international balance of payments trading, where the government of Argentina is taking a boatload of oil from Arabia, and the Arabs are taking a boatload of beef from Argentina. In international trade, those people aren't poor. There's nothing wrong with collateral in a business transaction. But let me tell you a couple of examples here. They've got a thing here in our state, the craziest thing I ever saw. It was enacted by the Democrats, the party of the people, the party of the people who are trying to protect the poor, the minimum wage earners, and the working class people, the union guys, you know. Yeah, it's passed by the Democrats, not the Republicans now. The Republicans, that's the party of the business interests. That's the party of the rich, the elite. You know, that's the story that you hear. They call them car title loans. And they charge 9.9% interest per month. And what you do is you take in your car interest or your car title. And let's say you got a $5,000 car. Well, first of all, they won't give you $5,000 on the car. They'll only give you $2,500. They'll give you 50 cents on the dollar. They give you $2,500 and charge you 9.9% interest per month. Now, that's 118% interest per year. That means that at the end of 1 year, you owe more than $2,500. More than $2,500. Now, is that interest? Is that usury? Now, they've got the car as collateral. The only person that would make a loan like this would have to be some guy that is so poor and so desperate that he doesn't have any other solution. Now, that's the kind of thing that God is decidedly opposed to. And, of course, the banks are right into that, right up to their eyeballs, along with the government and government agencies. I just wanted to point that out. Now, on the other hand, what if this same Bank of America is lending money to General Motors, which is a corporation? You got one corporation lending money to another corporation. Neither one of these guys are poor. And the bank says, well, we want you to put up your factory over here as collateral. Well, you want to borrow the money or not? Is this a business deal or isn't it? So when you look into the scripture, you find that the scripture makes all the sense in the world. And I find it unconscionable lending money at 118%. When I was a kid, if you lent the money over 6% interest, it was called usury. Today, the banks charge you anywhere from, I don't know, 15%, isn't it, on Discover, up to 28% on certain other credit cards. I don't have any, so I don't know exactly, but I read these numbers, you know, here and there. 15 to 28% interest. Now, isn't that usury? And who are they charging the usury to? Is it General Motors and IBM and Microsoft and Bill Gates, or are they charging that to Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, who are out here using those credit cards trying to keep up with the Joneses and getting in over their heads, filing for bankruptcy and getting divorced because they can't manage their money? So I think that that's the bottom line on usury. But notice that the collateral comes into play. You go out here and buy a house and you put your $5,000 down and they take the house as collateral, don't they? They not only take the house as collateral, they also have you sign a note, a personal guarantee. That way, if they repossess on the house, they give you 100% financing or 95% financing, and then they take the house, but the house doesn't bring as much as the debt against it. Now they can come back against you with a deficiency judgment. And then there's another factor that comes in here. Have you ever heard of the year of release and the jubilee? These debts, not only is there a law here on usury and interest and collateral, but there's also a law on credit and the extension of credit, which I think we ought to take up, and we'll do that in the next segment here. We'll take a look at land Sabbaths and jubilees. Because there's a credit system that the usury statutes just touch upon. And then there's the rest of the story, which comes out in land Sabbaths and jubilees, which if you're going to lend money to people, once every 7 years, that loan has to be forgiven. And we'll talk about that. And then once every 50 years, the land has to go back to its original owner. The land shall not be sold forever, God tells us. Well, now how can we have real estate and real estate law and licensed real estate brokers and salesmen and an industry called real estate like Coldwell Banker and these big outfits selling all of these properties over here if we've got to give the land back every 50 years? How does that work? Well, there's an economic system that's laid out here in the scripture. And usury and interest is just one facet of the credit system. Now, oppressing poor people, they're widows and orphans, you know, there are different penalties, you know, for different classes of crimes. So one of the things when you go to lend money or you go to lend something, if it's a female, the first thing I want to know is, are you a widow? And then when a female gets to be 60 years old, she's called a widow indeed. Do you think that you should be lending money to a 35-year-old woman with 3 kids and charging her usury and then taking collateral from her? Well, I don't think so. Now, stand by. We'll be right back with more on credit and usury when we come back right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? That's right. What's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, our public institutions, and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And now they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? Now, that's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. That's not separation of church and state, boys and girls. And there's still one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. Now, you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law, or the Law of God, or the Common Law, or Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we had a last segment here. We were talking about usury from a listener named Steve, who asked me about Matthew 25:27 and Luke 19:23. He said it doesn't make any sense. Well, that's part of the story, but the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, is found in another set of laws, or another portion of the scripture, which is called credit. So, some years back, I went through the entire Bible, and I code-pled out all of the laws. There are 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. Those laws, those statutes, judgments, and commandments are organized into 133 subjects of law, or titles of law. We do that in the U.S. Code. There are 50 titles of the U.S. Code, 50 subjects. So Title 18 is criminal law, Title 26 is tax law, Title 13 is the census laws, and so on. So each one of those titles is a subject matter. And sometimes they overlap one another. So when you take a look at usury, that's five statutes on usury. That is, one subject matter usury has five statutes that regulate and govern it. But it's pretty hard to talk about usury without talking about credit. Is it against the law to lend? Well, the answer is no, it's not against the law to lend. It's against the law to lend upon usury to somebody that's poor by you. So you have to make a judgment here. You're going to have to make a valuation. Can you lend to somebody and oppress them? Or can you lend to somebody in a business deal? Could I lend to somebody who's a corporation? Well, we got the answer to that under usury, but there's a little more to the story called credit. So we look at chapter 26 on credit. Usury is chapter 123. In Leviticus 25, verses 23, it says, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and your strangers and sojourners with me." And if a man sell a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it's sold. Within a full year may he redeem it. And if it be not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city shall be established forever to him that bought it through his generations, and it shall not go out in the Jubilee. My God, what's that all about? What are we talking about here? You can buy a house in a walled city? What's the difference between buying a house in a walled city or in the suburbs? And what about eminent domain? And what about a right of redemption? How do I redeem? What do you mean you're going to redeem this house back? Well, I got a second letter here from a fellow by the name of Harry, his wife Marie. Marie and Harry live in Tennessee. And they wrote me a letter, and it says, "When you have time, would you please review this article for correctness? I seek the true land Sabbath and Jubilee years, so I know if I have it right, it is so hard to, find truth in these times. Thank you, Harry." And then he sent me a 5-page article here on the Jubilees and the land Sabbaths. So I'm going to read the article, "The Jubilee and the Land Sabbath," because that's quite a topic. It's an obscure law. It's an obscure law that has a direct bearing on usury and interest. It has a direct bearing on buying and selling and trading real estate, farms and ranches and homes in the suburbs and so on. And to my knowledge, and I've been a legal researcher and been a historian for many, many years, a journalist, I have never read any stories or articles anywhere in history where anybody ever practiced land Sabbaths and Jubilees. I practice them. And I imagine that there are some people out there that practice it, but it's so rare that you'll find more people that practice the Passover than you will land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Now keep in mind that the Messiah said in Matthew 4 verse 4, repeated it in Luke 4 verse 4, directly cited it from Moses in Deuteronomy 8 verse 3. He said, "Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." And there are a number of statutes in the scripture that tell you to be very careful that you obey all of this law. Deuteronomy 30 is one of those chapters. It says, you make sure you practice all of this law. And here's an important little side note. You see, credit, usury, land Sabbaths, and Jubilees fit together like four fingers in a glove. And when you take one of those fingers out, where are you going to put your finger if there's no hole in the glove for it? So they either work together or they don't work separately very well. So you need to tuck that one away in your heart. If you're sitting here saying, "Well, I don't want to practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, but I do want to practice the usury laws. I want to make sure that I'm in compliance with the usury laws." How in the world can you practice one set of statutes without the rest? It's like trying to practice the traffic laws. You go out here and you say, "Well, you know, there's 2,000 traffic laws, and I want to practice about 1,995 of them, but there's 4 or 5 of them that I don't agree with, and I'm not going to practice those." Well, pretty soon Ranger Rick comes out and he gives you a ticket for running the stop sign, driving on the wrong side of the road. And you say, but that's not fair. That's not right. You see, I got a driver's license, registration, proof of insurance. I got my car inspected and I'm obeying 1,995 laws. And you know what the judge is going to tell you? "Well, we're not going to punish you for the 1,995 laws that you're in compliance with. We're just going to punish you for the 1, 2, or 5 laws that you're out of compliance with." And that's all God is doing. He's not going to punish you for the many laws that you're in compliance with. He's just going to punish you for the laws that you're out of compliance. That's what the bottom line is. So the Jubilees, the land Sabbaths, the usury statutes, and the credit laws all work together. And if you don't put all four of them together, you're whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Now, in the last segment, I said we'd read Matthew 27. Now, look over here in Luke 19. Now, remember, this is Steve. He says in Luke 19:23. Listen to the way Luke 19:23 words this. It says, "Wherefore then gavest not thou my money unto the bank, that at my coming I might have required my own with usury?" When Luke wrote this, he used a different word. And the English translators translated one, exchangers. You know, like Franklin Sanders puts out a paper called the Money Changer. And remember Jesus, he went into the temple and he overturned the money changers' tables. Money changers. And then we've got this thing called a bank over here. Now, a bank is a little more all-encompassing institution. You know, banks do a little bit more than just money change. They do that, but they do more than that. They offer more services than that. Now, I don't do business with banks because they've become criminal institutions. They don't have to be, but they are. It isn't that every transaction that goes on in the bank is a crime and violates the law of God. It's just that a lot of them do. And that's what the problem is with our society. We take a look at a particular institution like, you know, real estate. To sell real estate, you have to be a broker. To be a broker, you have to be licensed. A license, by definition, get this, a license, by definition, is a crime. Because a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. There are 15 licensed professions, and every one of them is a criminal activity. Your medical doctor is licensed. He's a criminal. He's in violation of Exodus 15, verse 26. The lawyer, he's a criminal. He's in violation of Luke 11, 37 through 54. You take every profession with every license. You got a driver's license, you're involved in a criminal endeavor, or you wouldn't have the license. I didn't write these definitions. Don't get mad at me. You know, I just got here in 1939 like everybody else. I showed up on planet Earth at a certain time. I'll be checking out here one of these days. And I'll have my little mark in history, you know. George Gordon arrived in 39, checked out in 2020 or something like that. And somebody will put up a grave marker and then I'll have my little niche. I didn't make it this way. I'm just reporting to you that that's the way it is. So when Steve writes me a letter and says, "Hey, listen, how come Jesus tells us over here usury and interest is okay and Moses says that it isn't?" Well, first of all, Moses didn't say that usury and interest was wrong in every single case. There are some exceptions to the rule. So that's number one. And then number two, we've got a credit law here that is wrapped up in this thing called Jubilees and Land Sabbaths that, to my knowledge, in the United States has never been practiced on any organized scale. And I've never heard of any church that ever taught, practiced, or would have anything to do with Land Sabbaths and Jubilees. And that includes the Jews. I'm not sure whether they do or don't practice Land Sabbaths and Jubilees, but I've never heard of them. And you know, I've talked to Jews all the time. I'm not anti-Jewish. I'm not anti-Christian, you know. I'm just pointing out that when I talk to Jews, they don't indicate to me that they're practicing Land Sabbaths and Jubilees. I've had them ask me, "How do you do that?" Gee, I need to check with the rabbi. I've never had one of them come back to me and say, "Well, here's what the rabbi said." Well, anyway, here's Marie and Harry, and they sent me this little article. So let's take a few minutes and let's run through an article. Now, I don't know. I guess I can find out here. The guy that wrote this article, he's got a name here. He's in the last page. And they wanted me to critique this article on Land Sabbaths and see. It was written by Richard Nichols and Giving and Sharing, P.O. Box 100, Next City, Missouri. and I'm sitting here, and I'm going to critique Richard Nichols' article here on land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Actually, it's not much to critique because he cited a number of scriptures. And so let me run through his article here, and we'll cite these scriptures. And then let's put credit, land Sabbaths, Jubilees, and usury together in a workable form. I practice all four, and I don't seem to have any problem with it, and I think that it's a good program. He starts off, he says, not only is there a weekly Sabbath, there is an annual Sabbath every 7 years, and then every 50 years there is a Jubilee Sabbath. So let's take a look at the Jubilee and sabbatical years. All right, let's pause right here for a moment. Take a look at statement number one. The guy's right. There's a weekly Sabbath that occurs every 7 days. Then there's an annual Sabbath that occurs once every 7 years. Then every 7 times 7 years is a Jubilee Sabbath, which occurs on the 50th year. Now, what is that 50th year? Is it 1937? You know, is it 2006? You know, what years are these Jubilees? And there are penalties that are ascribed to the violation of these Sabbaths. Now, you've got annual Sabbaths that are holy day Sabbaths. So, you've got the first and last day of unleavened bread, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. Now, those are Sabbaths that occur, seven of them, every year. Then you've got this annual, one-year-long Sabbath that occurs every 7 years, and then a Jubilee Sabbath every 50 years. So there's more than one Sabbath to be concerned with. Christians aren't concerned with anything other than Sunday, to my knowledge. I've never heard of anybody in Christendom ever say anything about annual Sabbath. Jews do. Now, the Jews practice the annual Sabbath and the weekly Sabbath. And then there's this great controversy over which day is the Sabbath. And then there's a controversy over which days and how do you calculate these annual Sabbaths. And then how do you calculate the land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Nobody ever talks about that. I think we can arrive at a conclusion there. In Exodus 23:10-12, we're told that the purpose of the seventh year is so that the poor and the animals shall eat. This applies also to the vineyard and the olive trees. The law has no limit to a specific time or a specific land. It is not limited to Palestine. The land Sabbath, or the land Sabbath law, would be enforced along with the weekly Sabbath. Then he says, fruit trees have slightly different statutes, and Leviticus 19:23-25 shows that the first 3 years' fruit shall be considered uncircumcised and not eaten. The fruit of the fourth year is all holy to the Eternal. You may eat the fruit in the fifth year. That's just a little off point. The land must keep a Sabbath, and Leviticus 25:1-7 describes the land Sabbath. Sowing is not permitted in the seventh year, and neither is pruning of the vineyard. You can't reap nor gather to store up that which grows of itself. Yet you can consume fresh anything that grows of itself, for the Sabbath of the land shall be meat for you, your servants, the stranger, and the beasts and cattle. It's a year of rest for the land, not for you. Well, I'm going to make a little comment there. Most of the people who write these kinds of articles are city people. I'm not a city people. I'm a farmer. The purpose for land Sabbaths is to refertilize the land. It's the fertilization system. And the way it works is very simple. If you plant corn on a piece of ground for 6 years, that corn that you harvest and ship off to market is so many tons per year, per acre, that you're harvesting out of the organic material in your soil. That's why we have to fertilize our land. We use chemical fertilizers because we don't practice land Sabbaths. I don't use chemical fertilizers, I practice land Sabbaths. And that refertilizes my land. And the cycle is once every 7 years. Very simple to follow. One time I was talking to a couple of Jewish fellows from New York. They had a winery. And I asked them, I said, do you practice land Sabbaths? And they were very interested. And they said, no, we don't, but we've thought about it. And I said, well, what's your annual fertilizer bill? Now, they produce around $5 million a year worth of wine out of this winery, their vineyard. And I forgot the exact numbers now, but, you know, they're spending $100,000, $300,000 a year on chemical fertilizers and sprays and one thing and another. And I said, well, you add that up over a period of 6 years, and then you take a year and you don't harvest anything. You just let the grapes grow, and you let them die on the vine and fall on the ground, and that would refertilize the land. And how much would that cost you? And they estimated that if they practiced the land Sabbath, that they would save about 1/6 over the cost of their chemical fertilizers. And I said, why don't you give it a try? And they said, well, it's an interesting thought, but we're talking about a lot of money. We know what works, and we know that we make a profit. The fact that we could make a 16% greater profit is tantalizing, but we probably don't want to take the risk. Well, okay, now if you don't want to practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, then you're on a slippery slope, because you keep mining the organic material out of the soil. And at some point in time, when the organic material reaches critical mass, no amount of chemicals or pesticides will make enough grow to make it economically viable. There are many waste places around the world where this has already been tested. Wenatchee, Washington is one case, or Yakima, where they had these apple trees. I guess it's the Yakima Valley, where we were spraying so much arsenic on them, they've just turned that land into a moonscape. And that's where America's land is ultimately going. I don't know if it'll take another 100 years, but desertification is seen in some places in Iowa today. Desertification in Iowa is beginning because we won't practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, and you can only mine so much organic material out of the soil until it's all gone. So the primary purpose now of land Sabbaths is refertilization of the land. So you people in the city may not understand how that works, and if you've never practiced it, I practice it so I can see how it works, and a good understanding of all they who do his commandments. So the guy that does the law, the guy that actually practices the law over time, is going to come up with a little better understanding than some guy that lives in New York City and reads the Bible and tries to envision what's being talked about. Now in Leviticus 25:18-19, he goes on to say, if we observe the seventh year, God promises that we will dwell in the land safely and have plenty of food to eat. Leviticus 25:19, God promises a blessing in the sixth year. Leviticus 25:20-22. That's true. That's what we call bumper crops. So every sixth year, you're entitled to a bumper crop to carry you through that seventh year when you're not planting and harvesting. Seventh year is also called the year of release. So in Deuteronomy 15:1-18, the seventh year is called the Lord's release, and all debts are to be forgiven. The reason for this law is to relieve the poor. Exodus 21:1-6 describes how Hebrew servants are to be released in the seventh year unless they voluntarily desire to be lifelong servants. Deuteronomy 31:9-13 says that the law is to be read at the end of the seventh year at the Feast of Tabernacles. This would ensure that former debtors and servants were properly taught God's law so that they might not have to become poor again. That's correct. So in every land Sabbath year at the Feast of Tabernacles, when you went up there, the priests, the Levites, would read this entire law to everybody so that everybody in the land, once every 7 years, is informed as to what the law is, a part of ongoing or continuing education. The 50th year is the Jubilee. Leviticus 25:8-55 describes the 50th or Jubilee year. The Jubilee means liberty. God owns the land, and in the Jubilee he wants the return of every man to his possession. The land must be redeemed. Men must be returned to their land, their family. Beginning on the Day of Atonement with the sound of a trumpet, the Jubilee is a holy year, verse 12. Leviticus 27:14-34 describes the redemption of gifts and tithes, which are calculated based on the number of years to the Jubilee. Well, just briefly, let me explain it. Let's suppose that you come to me and you say, "Hey, Gordon, I would like to buy 40 acres from you." And I would point out to you, Leviticus 25:23, that the land shall not be sold forever. Boy, that runs right in the face of real estate brokers. The land shall not be sold forever. That means you can't buy and sell and make merchandise of your inheritance. Well, then how do you get hold of the land? Well, you go out and claim it. Now, we Americans did practice that. From about 1820 to 1963-64, we used to go out and claim the land under the Land Patent Act of 1820. You claim it, and then you pass it on to your firstborn son under the inheritance law. Well, we don't practice the inheritance law in the United States, and we wanted to buy, sell, and trade with land. We wanted to make merchandise of it, so we created real estate law, and that's what we practice today, real estate law. Now the government has closed the land window, so you can't claim land. And why is that? Well, because if you could go out and claim the public land, why in the world would you want real estate? Wouldn't you just want to lock up the land so that you can buy, sell, and trade it? It affects real estate values. And the less real estate that there is on the market, the higher the value of the real estate that is on the market. It's just follow the money, stupid. That's all there is to that. So we don't want to be out here claiming public land. We want to lock up the public land, about one-third of America, so that we can maintain real estate values. And we do, and we have, and that's the purpose behind it. So this 50th year, then, is a Jubilee year, and the writer, the listener here, wants to know, well, what year is the 50th year? Well, I calculated that out. Now, there's a number that they've got in here, and I think it's 1913 and 1963. And there's a little collateral or circumstantial evidence. You see, the Emancipation Proclamation was written in 1863 that freed the American slaves. I don't think that was an accident. Ivan Panin wrote a chronology of the Bible. And the 390 missing years between Joshua and Samuel are reconstructed in Panin's chronology. If you'd like a copy of it, send me a $5 gold piece or 5 silver dollars, and I'll send that to you. It's about 130 or 40 pages, as I recall. And that's the chronology that I've been going by. And 1813 was the middle of the War of 1812, which was the punishment or the penalty that you pay for not practicing land Sabbaths and Jubilees. And the income tax was enacted in 1913, which is, again, a penalty because 1913 was a Jubilee year. Now, I'll come back next time and we'll talk more about this Jubilee and Land Sabbath. I'm about out of time here today, so we'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, and religion. Hey, I'm out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.